Welcome to episode 71 of the Fredcast for the week of May 21st, 2007. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. Welcome back to another episode of the Fredcast. In today's show, an update on the results from the Floyd Landis hearing, current standings in the 2007 Giro d'Italia, the results of Princess Diana's bike auction, a buzzard attacks a cyclist, and how high-heeled shoes caused a cyclist's death. Following that, I've got some tips and tricks from some veteran long-distance cyclists. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. The Fredcast is brought to you by Cambria Bicycle Outfitter, providing quality products to bicycle consumers for over 20 years. Go to www.thefredcast.com to check out the Fredcast's picks of the week, and also to find out how you can receive free shipping on your next order. Cambria Bicycle Outfitter, they outfit the world. Welcome back to another episode of the Fredcast. This issue of the Fredcast is going to be primarily news because there's a lot to talk about. So let's get right down to it. And let's start with probably the subject that is on the minds, if not the lips, of most cyclists that I've met over the last couple of weeks, and that is the Floyd Landis hearings that have been going on in Malibu, California. Now, those hearings are over. There will be some more briefs that will be filed in the case, and then the USADA panel will issue its judgment, and that may not be for several weeks, if not months. In the meantime, while we're waiting for their verdict, let's just cover some of the high and low points of the last week and a half of testimony in that case. Now, first, I just want to spend a moment talking about how we got to this point. You'll remember that Floyd Landis was riding in the Tour de France in 2006 for the Phonak cycling team. Now, the 2006 Tour de France was marred before it even began by doping allegations when the Operation Puerto affair surfaced out of Spain, and there were dozens of cyclists that were implicated as potentially having been involved in this doping scandal that was taking place at the lab of Dr. Eufemiano Fuentes. This took several of the major contenders out of the race, and you'll recall that this was the first Tour de France in the post-Lance Armstrong era. So guys like Jan Ulrich, who were implicated in the Puerto affair, were not allowed to race, and that left the field essentially wide open. Now, on stage 16 of last year's race, Floyd Landis, who was widely seen as one of the front runners once the race began, seemed to explode in the middle of the race. Quite simply, he bonked. He ran out of energy during the race, and it seemed as if his chances to do anything in the 2006 Tour de France were all but over. Then came stage 17. And in stage 17, Floyd Landis tore up the roads as he pulled away from the pack and never looked back. And it looked like a Herculean effort as he stormed to a stage victory and then went on to win the Tour de France as they rolled down the Champs-Élysées on the last stage. That seemed to be a Cinderella story, an amazing event, and he was widely lauded for an amazing athletic achievement. Then just days later, it was announced that one prominent rider, had tested positive for doping based on the doping controls that were in place at the Tour de France. And it was learned very quickly that that prominent rider who was under suspicion for doping was Floyd Landis. Ever since that point, Floyd Landis has fought against these allegations and consistently demanded that he's innocent and that he did not dope. What he was accused of was an elevated testosterone to epitestosterone level, and then later accused of having synthetic testosterone in too large of a level. And that is what he was accused of. As a result, he was brought up on charges, and the United States Anti-Doping Agency was brought in to adjudicate his case. Over the last several months, Floyd Landis and his team have fought a public battle to bring to light what they say are inconsistencies in the testing process, as well as procedural violations that took place at the lab as well as within the UCI. Finally, Floyd Landis was given his day in court. He arrived, as I mentioned before in the previous Fredcast, in a yellow tie, and he came in a yellow tie nearly every day. That yellow tie, of course, symbolizing the yellow jersey of the leader of the Tour de France. That is how we got to this point. Now let's talk a little bit about what happened in the courtroom at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. The first side to present their case was the USADA side, and their lawyers sought to prove that the proper procedures were followed and that the results of those procedures and of those tests were that Floyd Landis did dope at the 2006 Tour de France. Perhaps one of the biggest bombshells of their case, among others, was the testimony of a fairly low-level pro cyclist, Joe Papp. Now, Joe Papp has been on suspension for supposed doping, and in his testimony, he admitted that he actually had used testosterone in his cycling career, and then he said something which contradicts a lot of what many people have been saying about the use of testosterone. You see, people have been saying that had Floyd actually used testosterone after stage 16, it wouldn't have had an effect on his physiology and on his recovery. But instead, Papp said, quote, "There was a significant improvement in recovery. There was no cumulative fatigue when I used testosterone." According to Joe Papp, what he would do is he would, quote, "After a doping control, or if you knew you wouldn't be tested, you just find a discreet location and rub it on your chest." And he's talking about using a gel called Androgel, which is a testosterone gel. He then said that the effects of the testosterone could be felt within 30 minutes, and that if you used small enough doses, it wouldn't trigger a positive test in the anti-doping screening. In fact, Joe Papp said that he had passed two anti-doping tests while he was using testosterone. Now, perhaps the biggest bombshell of the case, and probably the one that has, in my opinion, the least factual basis, was the one that was dropped by professional cyclist Greg LeMond. Now, of course, Greg is the three-time winner, the American winner, of the Tour de France. LeMond said that he had had a telephone conversation with Floyd Landis in August, after it was revealed that Floyd Landis was the one whose test came back positive. Now, prior to this, in July, after Floyd Landis won, Greg LeMond was the one who was lauding Floyd Landis. He was the one who was complimenting him for not only being a good cyclist, but using the word, quote, "clean" to describe Floyd Landis. Nevertheless, Floyd Landis called Greg LeMond in early August of 2006 because he wanted to discuss with LeMond some comments that LeMond had made in the media about Floyd Landis. Now, after LeMond got off over the initial surprise that Floyd Landis was calling, they had a conversation about the use of doping products. And in that conversation, LeMond claims that because of some statements that Landis made, he claims that Landis admitted to using doping in the Tour de France. If you read the testimony of what Greg LeMond claims Floyd Landis said, Greg LeMond is having a conversation with Landis in which he encourages him that if he did dope, that he should come clean. And Floyd Landis says, "What good would it do?" Now, Floyd Landis didn't actually admit to anything. All he was saying was, in this hypothetical case, if I did dope, what good would it do to admit it? So I don't think that that is an admission of anything. The problem, however, is that in this case, Floyd could be seen to be guilty by association. Association with whom, you may ask? Well, with his former business manager, Will Gohagan. You see, the night before Greg LeMond was scheduled to testify in the Landis affair, Will Gohagan called Greg LeMond's cell phone and all but threatened him on the phone. Whether or not there was an actual threat or an implicit threat really is irrelevant because, according to the rules, what Will Gohagan did could quite possibly be considered witness tampering. Greg LeMond did file a police report, and although as soon as this came out in the courtroom, Floyd Landis fired Will Gohagan as his business manager, nevertheless, Greg LeMond says that he'll be filing witness tampering charges against Will Gohagan. Now, since then, Will Gohagan has entered rehab, as seems to be the thing to do when you do a bad thing these days, but we'll see what happens and whether or not that case goes forward. There was a lot of testimony from lab technicians and WADA experts about the validity of the tests in the Landis case, and then it was Landis's side's turn. And when they got up there, they, of course, brought up their experts who seemed to show that the machinery at the French laboratory was faulty, that the technicians were poorly trained, that dates were erased, names were changed, that the technicians knew inappropriately that the samples were indeed Floyd Landis's, that time logs were changed, and that all of this shows that the French lab and the water results cannot be trusted, and as a result, they should be thrown out. Over the next few weeks, there will not be a verdict in this case. 2 weeks it's going to take for the transcripts to come out, another 2 weeks for the lawyers to file legal briefs, and then a minimum of 2 weeks before the arbitrators in the case will come to a decision. Check your calendars, folks, because that means that quite possibly we could see a decision in this case in the middle of the 2007 Tour de France. And don't forget that no matter what the result is in this particular hearing, both sides still have the opportunity to appeal the result to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And even if Floyd Landis loses all of these proceedings and they want to hand the yellow jersey to the second place finisher, well, that would be Oscar Pereiro. Oscar Pereiro, it is widely rumored, may be connected to the Operation Puerto affair. Now, of course, those are just allegations. Nothing's been proven. But if that's the case, then it would go to the third place finisher of last year's Tour de France. And this all could happen well after the 2007 Tour de France has concluded. It's quite a tangled web. I know you hate hearing about it, but it just goes to show how widespread and how deep these doping troubles are in professional cycling. Speaking of widespread and deep, let's talk for a moment about the T-Mobile team and their problems. This week, three former team riders and two team doctors admitted to their part in doping in the 1990s when the T-Mobile team was known as Team Telecom. In addition, the current director sportif, Rolf Aldag, who competed in the Tour de France 10 times as a rider for the team, admitted to doping between 1995 and 2002, and well-known rider Eric Zabel, who won 12 stages of the Tour de France, also said that he tried EPO in 1996. He said, quote, "I tried doping because it was possible. There were no tests for it back then. The controls were very loose," he said. And now, one of the most famous riders from that team, Bjarne Riis, has now scheduled a press conference for Friday. We don't know what he's going to be talking about, but the 1996 Tour de France champion very well could be talking about, it's rumored, his part in some of these doping allegations. We'll see what happens. It would be a tragedy, especially considering the success that Bjarne Riis is having as one of the managers and directors of Team CSC. This is a tragedy. I can't tell you how tired I'm getting, not only of talking about doping, but of hearing about doping in professional cycling. This sport has to come clean, and has to come clean soon. And speaking of the sport and racing, and hopefully racing clean, we are in the middle of the 2007 Giro d'Italia, which goes all the way until June the 3rd. Today was stage number 12, and when we last were here together on the Fredcast, we were at stage number 3, and Gasparotto was wearing the Maglia Rossa, or the pink jersey, as the leader of the Giro d'Italia. That pink jersey has gone back and forth. Danilo De Luca wore it several days. Pinotti was winning the jersey for several days. Noe was wearing it for a couple of days. And then today was stage 12. And after today's stage 12, which was won by Italy's Danilo De Luca, he's back in the pink. He outsprinted Gilberto Simoni to win what was the first key mountain stage of this year's race. He won it in 4 hours, 46 minutes, and 39 seconds as a result of his stage win, which was the second stage that he had won in this year's Giro. He's now 1 minute and 3 seconds ahead of the rest of the pack in the overall standings. And he said, quote, "It's nice to be back in the pink jersey. I've got a bit of a lead on my rivals, but the Giro is still wide open." That's very, very true. Tomorrow, Friday, is the 13th stage. It's a 12.6 kilometer uphill individual time trial from Biella to Santuario di Europa. The general classification standings as of right now show De Luca in the lead, followed by Mario Brusseghin from Italy, 1 minute and 3 seconds back, David Arroyo Duran from Spain, 1 minute and 16 seconds back, Andy Schleck from Luxembourg, 1 minute and 25 seconds back, and Francisco Javier Villa Erradonia, 1 minute and 39 seconds back. There are still 9 stages left in this year's Giro d'Italia, and even De Luca has said that it is still a wide open race. 1 minute and 3 seconds at this point really is nothing, and he's got a lot of work in order to defend that if he decides to do so. So there's a lot left to go in this year's Giro. We'll have more results for you next week right here on the Fredcast. Okay, it's time to get away from racing and doping and talk about some everyday cycling, things that matter to those of you who are out there on the road and on the trails fairly often. And this one's a biggie because it's another one of those recalls, and this one could affect a lot of you out there, so pay attention. Cannondale has voluntarily issued a safety recall notice with the Consumer Product Safety Commission here in the United States. The products that are affected are any 2007 and some 2008 mountain bikes equipped with either Lefty Speed Carbon SL or Lefty Speed DLR2 front forks. If your bike is equipped with one of these forks, I say this all the time, stop riding the bike, take it to your Cannondale dealer to get the required service. According to Chris Peck, the vice president of R&D at Cannondale, quote, "Unfortunately, there have already been injuries due to this issue, and we strongly urge anyone that has purchased one of these bikes to contact their dealer immediately and have your bike inspected." Now, apparently Cannondale has found an error in the assembly process of the forks, which could allow the telescoping assembly of the fork to completely separate. The safety recall is being distributed to all the authorized Cannondale dealers, and you can get more information there. Of course, there's links in the show notes to the recall notice from which I was just reading, as well as to a specific PDF file that gives you more information. In the meantime, the following bikes are the ones that could be affected: the 2007 models of the Rush Carbon 2, Taurine Carbon Team Replica, Scalpel 1, Scalpel Team Replica, Rush Carbon 1, Rush Carbon Team, and of course there could be aftermarket replacement Lefty forks that you may have purchased. The ones that might have the Lefty Speed Carbon SL forks include 2007 models of the Rush 3, Rush 4, Rush 5, the Caffeine 29er, Scalpel 2, Scalpel 3, Caffeine 1, Caffeine 2, Rush Feminine 1, and the 2008 Rush Carbon. If you suspect that you may have one of these, please immediately stop riding the bike, take it to your Cannondale dealer, and get it fixed. This is too important for you to ignore. Now, we've talked here on the Fredcast about the fact that it is National Bike Month during May 2007, and we remember that last week was Bike to Work Week and Bike to Work Day. I found an interesting article from an Asian newspaper, which is indicating that the Taiwan Minister of Transportation and Communications, a gentleman by the name of Tsai Tue, said last week that his ministry is studying the feasibility of implementing measures to promote cycling as a mode of commuting as part of their efforts to deal with traffic problems around the country. Why do I think this is interesting? Well, two reasons. Number one, as you well know, Taiwan is one of the largest manufacturers of bicycles and bicycle components in the world. It only seems logical to me that a country that produces so many bicycle products would want to promote cycling as a means of transportation. Having said that comes the second reason why I think this is so interesting. Having gone to Taiwan fairly frequently when I was in the bicycle industry, several times a year, every year, the traffic and the pollution from the traffic in the major cities in Taiwan, the traffic is just horrendous. And as a result, they have a lot of pollution from the cars and the motorbikes. There's a lot of people who use motorbikes, mopeds, and scooters as their means of transportation. I remember seeing whole families on one little scooter, a couple of kids, the mom and dad, all commuting to school and to work. So it would only seem to me that cycling would be a great way for a country like this to commute. Here's the problem. The traffic is very bad in these cities. The drivers, especially the taxi drivers, well, let's put it this way. When you get in a taxi in Taiwan, sometimes you take your life in your own hands. I've had some very wild rides in taxis, especially in the capital city of Taipei. So I think if they're going to promote cycling in Taiwan, it's a great idea, but I think they're going to need bike lanes. I think they're going to need a little bit more emphasis on safety, especially with the taxi drivers. But I do laud them for their efforts of trying to promote cycling as transportation, and I hope that that's something that going forward in the future is something that not only will happen in Taiwan, but in many of the other industrialized nations around the world, including, by the way, here in North America. Now, of course, any city that wants to promote cycling needs to have good bike lanes and needs to have good unobstructed bike lanes. Well, today, May 24th, the organization in New York called the Time's Up Bicycle Clown Brigade, which was made up of cyclists dressed like clowns, rode through Midtown Manhattan handing out mock parking tickets to motorists who were parked in the bike lanes. Now, New York City traffic law says that you cannot park, stand, or stop in bicycle lanes, and that law carries a $115 fine. The Time's Up Bicycle Clown Brigade believes that by handing out these mock tickets to motorists in the bike lanes, they'll draw attention to what they believe the New York Police Department should be doing, which is enforcing the laws that protects cyclists. Now, we all have run into situations where we're riding through a bike lane, we have that extra buffer zone that the bike lane provides, but then we find somebody who has parked their car in the middle of the bike lane illegally, forcing us to go around the car and get into traffic where, of course, it's going to be more dangerous. This organization believes that by handing out these tickets, they'll be raising a little bit of awareness and hopefully scaring the driver just a little bit when they get to their car, because according to the picture that I've seen, and I put a link in the show notes so you can take a look at it yourself, this looks like a real ticket, but instead they've written on it, "This could have been a real ticket," and then it quotes section 4-08E of the local code, telling them about the law and about the fact that they could have been subject to a $115 fine. And then at the bottom it says, "So please share the streets. Don't block bike lanes." I think this is a great idea. They're not looking to make confrontation. They're just looking to inform the public and let them know about the danger of parking in bike lanes, as well as the fact that it is indeed illegal. I think it's a great idea, and I hope that it works for them. Go ahead and check it out. Links are in the show notes. Hey, speaking of promoting cycling, you all know that here on the show I've been talking a lot about promoting cycling among kids. Just listen to the last show that I put out with my daughter Emily on it, and promoting cycling among fifth graders who got to ride across the state of California. Well, Olympic cyclist Aaron Mirabella, who represented the United States in cycling at the 2000 and 2004 Summer Olympic Games, has teamed up with illustrator Lisa Horstman to create a book, a children's book, about cycling. It's called Gracie Goat's Big Bike Race. The book is available at velogear.com, and then it'll be available in bookstores throughout North America in June. This is Mirabella's first book, and it was inspired by her own Olympic experiences. It addresses teamwork and facing one's fears with a creative and lighthearted touch that children ages 5 and up really should enjoy. In the book, it not just talks about the challenges of learning to ride a bike, which is something kids think about a lot, but it also helps explain the sport of cycling and the teamwork that goes into a bike race. Because, you know, as we've all learned, a lot of us who are really into cycling, we understand the teamwork that's involved, we understand the strategy, but sometimes that's a little bit tough for kids to understand. So this looks like a great book and something that hopefully kids will really enjoy. I encourage you to check it out, and I have put links in the show notes. Now, of course, the most famous children's bike that went on auction recently was the childhood bicycle of Diana, the Princess of Wales. You'll remember that it was going on auction and that it was a former housekeeper of Diana's family that was putting it up at auction. Well, the auction is over. The 1970s-style tracker bike sold for £1,200 at auction last week, and it was sold to a businessman, Mr. Alan Goldsmith. He bought it to, quote, save it for the country, and he was actually a bit relieved that he only had to pay £1,200, because initially he feared that it was going to go for well over £10,000, and he attributes the low price to the fact that there were few transatlantic bidders at the auction, because he said, quote, Princess Diana is much more collectible in America than here. She's the biggest icon of the 20th century, and I'm delighted to have saved the bike for the East Anglian region and for the country. So it's going to be going on display at a local museum owned by Mr. Goldsmith. It's called the House on the Hill Toy Museum in Lower Street, and apparently it will never be up for auction again. Well, I don't know about you and how you may feel about high heels, but I can tell you that it seems to be clear that a certain model's high heels may have killed a cyclist. Former model Julie Hunter, who's 42 years old, was test driving an Alfa Romeo Spider in 2005 in England. She was driving it and she swerved around a parked car at 50 miles per hour in a 30 mile per hour zone. The car spun out of control, ended up on the wrong side of the road, and plowed into a cyclist, fitness instructor Debbie Riches, who was 21 years old. Riches was killed, and Hunter, the driver, was taken to the hospital unconscious. According to an accident investigator at Hunter's trial, it turned out that nothing was wrong with the car. They confirmed that there had been no mechanical faults with the car or with the bicycles, but the accident investigator said that Hunter's, quote, very high heels may have inhibited the defendant's ability to drive. Now, originally, Hunter faced up to 14 years in jail for causing death by dangerous driving, but she received an 8-month suspended sentence and 7-year driving ban when she pled guilty the day before her trial was supposed to take place. According to the judge, she was responsible for, quote, a short burst of dangerous activity, not wicked recklessness. The defendant, for all her errors, didn't mean to do harm. She was guilty of fault, not deliberate wickedness, the fault of serious negligence with terrible and disproportionate results. So, what's the lesson here? Number one, don't drive 50 in a 30, don't swerve around parked cars, and don't wear 2 1/4 inch heels when you're driving. Finally, it appears that cyclists in England just may not be very safe, because first it was crazed models in high heels, and now cyclists are being attacked by buzzards. A man from Cornwall was attacked by a bird of prey while riding his bike in North Devon. Ewan Mahi was left covered in blood after the bird, thought to be a buzzard, sank its talons into his head. Mr. Mahi was left with small puncture wounds to his scalp, and bird experts said he could have been badly injured. He told the BBC, quote, "I was cycling along this very quiet road when I felt this awesome thud. I turned round and saw this bird with its talons outstretched, retreating away from me. It was quite incredible. I can't believe it was in exactly the same spot as previous attacks have occurred. I think other cyclists should watch out and look around because they will be attacked." Now, this is the part that I really love from this story from the BBC. A gentleman by the name of Tom Screech from the Screech Owl Sanctuary said the bird's behavior is unusual but potentially dangerous. He said, quote, "They're about the same weight as a bag of sugar. Imagine that coming from the trees about 50 feet above you. Their talons are razor sharp, so if it hit you on the back of the head, it could be very serious." Now, according to the story in the BBC, one idea is that this bird might have lived in captivity and it's used to humans. But if it's used to humans, why is it attacking them is my question. According to the story, buzzards can live for more than 25 years, so it's thought likely to be the same bird that has attacked other cyclists in the same area before. Personally, I thought that buzzards and vultures only went after things that were dead. Somebody riding a bike clearly is not dead.
I'm not dead.
What? Nothing. Here's your ninepence.
I'm not dead.
Here. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not.
He isn't?
Well, he will be soon. He's very ill.
I'm getting better.
No, you're not. You'll be stone dead in a moment.
Oh, I can't take him like that. It's against regulations.
I don't want to go on the car.
Oh, don't be such a baby.
I can't take him.
I feel fine.
Well, do us a favor.
And that marks the expiration of the news for this week on the Fredcast. Well, just a couple of notes and a few items that I just want to mention before we get out of here for this week. Number one, don't forget that the Fredcast socks are still available. Go to www.thefredcast.com and get them before they run out. They're going very fast. Thank you all for your orders. We very much appreciate it. Then I have a question for you. Over the next week or so, take a look at your calendar and see if you're going to be busy the week of September 2nd through the 9th. I've got a special announcement coming up in the next 14 days. Take a look at your calendars, see if you might be available over those dates, September 2nd through the 9th, 2007. I'll have details coming soon on where you could go and what you could do during those dates. So I'm just going to leave you hanging with that. Stay tuned to the Fredcast for more details. It seems that one of the themes we seem to come back to over and over again here on the Fredcast is the need for cyclists to have a great way to map out new routes and new areas that they can go to. We've talked about a lot of different services here. We've talked about RouteSlip.com and Bikely and a number of others. And one that I use all the time for driving and for knowing where I'm going when I'm in a strange place is Google Maps. And that's, of course, at maps.google.com. But I've never found it very useful for planning out a ride out on the road. Well, Google Maps has recently added a feature, something that I found out about on the Cyclicious blog, and of course there's a link in the show notes to that wonderful cycling blog. And this is the feature that will allow you to avoid highways. This is something I've always hoped that Google Maps would put in, because I'm one of these people, I get bored on highways. I really prefer side roads and frontage roads and places where you can actually get out and see a little bit of the location where you are, because every highway, every freeway looks the same. I don't care if you're in Asia or Europe or North America, they all look the same. They all look like a freeway, and you really want to get out and see a little bit of the local culture. But beyond that, you also want to ride your bike when you're not on a highway. So when you go to Google Maps and when you get directions from place A to place B, normally it will route you the fastest route, and typically that takes you on a highway or a freeway. But now, once you've gotten your directions, there's a little box just above your directions that says simply avoid highways. When you put a check mark into that box, you will then get a road map that will take you on roads that probably, not always, but are probably going to be much more suited for cyclists. I mapped out a couple of routes earlier today using it in a variety of different places, including someplace that I'm going this weekend where I've always wondered how I could get from point A to point B on a bicycle. And sure enough, it took me a great way, in a way that I will probably go when I go riding there. So check it out. It's at maps.google.com and use the Avoid Highways option. I've put links in the show notes. I hope that works out well for you. Finally, we've talked on the show before about the AIDS Life Cycle event, and we've also talked about some good friends of the show, Team Ventura, here in California. And I get emails from Casey, who is I suppose a former neighbor. He lives very close to the neighborhood where I used to live, and he's also one of the people in charge of Team Ventura. Team Ventura is a family of friends dedicated to cycling together and helping turning new riders into new friends. And every year, they train riders for AIDS Life Cycle, which is a 550-mile, 7-day ride from San Francisco to Los Angeles to raise millions of dollars to treat and prevent HIV and AIDS. This coming weekend is when the AIDS Life Cycle is beginning, and because I'm on Casey's email distribution list, I was able to get some of the tips that Casey sent out to his riders this week, and I asked Casey if I could share these with you because I think that these are great tips anytime you're participating in a group ride, whether it's the AIDS Life Cycle or any other organized group ride. And so, Casey, I want to thank you for sending these to me, and I wanted to pass these along to the Fredcast listeners. So the first one is slow down. In this case, it says you're going to be riding for 7 days, so conserve your energy. But that's good whether you're doing a 100-mile ride, a 200-mile ride, or a multi-day ride. If you normally cruise at 16 miles per hour, you might want to take it down to 14. You've got a lot of miles to ride and tens of thousands of feet to climb, so take it easy. The next one says, don't stop at the first rest stop on day one. Now, I questioned that myself. So Casey says, why? It's a good question. On day one, everybody rides out together. Everybody leaves the start line together. And this is the same thing when it comes to certain organized rides you do, even if they're only single day rides. As a result, 2,000 cyclists with bulging bladders all arrive at the first rest stop at the same time. The line for the porta potties can be an hour. There's always a convenient gas station a block or two down the road, and there's always a convenient bush around the corner. Next one, and this is very important, water is not enough. When you sweat, you lose more than water. You lose electrolytes, the chemical salts that your body needs. That's why you must use some kind of sports drink that will replace those electrolytes. A lot of people like Cytomax, a lot of people use Gatorade, and other drinks that are out there. Just remember, don't use only water. Okay, now the next one. You know, it's important, and sometimes it may elicit giggles, but I think it's something that bears mentioning. Be careful where you squat. Speaking of those convenient bushes that we talked about a little while ago, every year on this ride, a few unlucky riders take a potty break in a bush, only to find out that that bush is really poison ivy or poison oak. Now, just imagine a major case of poison oak coming between you and your saddle. That's not a pretty picture, is it? So the trick is to look for leaves that come in threes. The slogan is leaves of three, let it be. So keep that in mind because that's the last, I mean, nobody wants poison ivy, but that's the last place you want it. So keep that in mind. Next one, and it's a great tip, and I think that this is something that I've probably mentioned before, and if I haven't, it's something that you got to keep in mind. Of course, it says don't get hurt, but listen to the reasons why. Most AIDS life cycle accidents happen on day one and day seven. And by the way, this is also true on even a single day ride. Most of the accidents happen at the beginning of the ride or at the very end of the ride. Why is that, you ask? Well, let's look at day one. In this case, when 2,000 cyclists all try to be on the same street at the same time, accidents can happen. When most of those cyclists are nervous and excited, it gets even more dangerous. Now, when those 2,000 nervous and excited people are all scanning the crowds, lining the street, looking for their loved ones, well, I think you get the idea. So be careful at the beginning of a ride. Now, you also have to be careful at the end of a ride. Now, in this case, it's 7 days, but imagine it's 100 miles and you're at mile 70 or 80 or 90. You're exhausted. You're also excited about getting home and finishing. You're worrying about your ride home, how you're going to smell when you hug your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your wife or your kids. The bottom line is you're exhausted and you're excited at the same time. And a lot of times people simply aren't paying enough attention. Okay. The next tip simply says chamois butter. It may look like sunblock, but it's actually for sticking, well, you know where you put it. It can be your friend. And from somebody who just did a multi-day ride, I think that chamois butter or any other kind of skin lubricant, we've talked about this on the show before, is invaluable. Make sure you use it. Here's some great tips about avoiding saddle sores. Number one, always wear clean cycling shorts. Seems commonsensical, doesn't it? But sometimes people don't do that, and that can lead to saddle sores. Next, remove your shorts as soon as you can when you get to camp or home or wherever you are, because if you wear those dirty shorts, it could lead to saddle sores. Next, antibiotic ointment. Apply it to your undercarriage before applying chamois butter in the morning. The places where your bottom hits the saddle are easy places to get little pimple-like infections. Saddle sores. They hurt, so make sure that you take care of them. Did I need to mention sunscreen? It's incredibly important. I don't need to tell you why. Use lots. Apply it often. It's very, very important. The next one, and I think that this really depends from person to person, but it says you don't have to stop at every pit stop. The pit stops are wonderfully entertaining on the AIDS life cycle, but that doesn't mean you have to visit every single one. It's always more work to stop and start again than it is to keep going. So decide if you need to stop. Do you need food? Do you need water? Do you need a toilet? Do you need bike repairs? Do you need a break? If not, you might want to consider keeping going, but make sure you look down at that route slip to determine where that next rest stop is going to be, because if you're getting a little close, you know, sometimes it's better to err on the side of caution, stop for a short time, fill up the water bottle, put a couple of power bars or cliff bars or whatever they're serving in your jersey pocket, and then get quickly back on the road. Next, and these two things have to do with when you're finished riding for the day, make sure that you recover right. When you stop riding for the day, start eating immediately, especially if you're doing as many miles as they're doing on the AIDS life cycle. By that, they mean eating power bars, eating cliff bars, having some goo or some gel, whatever you like. Your body can replenish its stores of glycogen. And remember, that's the stuff that fuels your muscles overnight, but only if you eat enough carbohydrates within the first 30 minutes of getting off of your bike. The 30-minute period is called the glycemic window. I like what they say in these tips. Don't take their word for it. Google it. And don't worry. Sorry, Mom. It won't spoil your dinner. Finally, hydrate at night in between your rides. It's very important. You see everybody hydrating very, very well. Not everybody, but a lot of people hydrating very, very well on their bikes. But then when they get off their bikes, they don't drink enough. Just as you've heard me say before that if you're getting ready for a big ride, you need to start prehydrating days and days before. Well, now that you're on the ride, you need to also prehydrate the night before. So make sure that you're doing that. These are a couple of great tips. I want to thank Casey and Team Ventura for sharing them with me and allowing me to share them with you. They're just a couple of the great tips that you can use when you get ready for your next big ride. If you can, go to the website, check out my show notes, go to teamventura.org, check out what they're doing. And if you've got the ability, you might want to also send them a donation or two, because what they're doing is a fantastic thing for a lot of people and for research that is critically important. Check it out. Links are in the show notes. Well, for the most part, that's going to do it for tonight's issue of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. I apologize once again for it being just a little bit late, a couple of days late. I've got some things going on in my schedule right now over the next month or two that may make it just a little bit off as far as our schedule. I still will get you one a week or more if I can, but certainly one a week. I apologize if I'm going to be off by a day or two, but trust me, the show will be there. And after, say, the middle of July, I think we should be back to a much more regular schedule, certainly for the Tour de France. So don't worry too much about that. In the meantime, if you've got any comments for me, please do send me an email. The email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. And by the way, speaking of that, I have to tell you right now that sometimes it does get a little bit difficult to answer every single email that comes in because I do get a fairly high volume from you. I love getting your emails. I want you to know that I read every one and I do try to reply to as many as possible. Trust me when I tell you that I do read every single email. And please do keep sending them. If you like, you can also send me a voicemail. And the listener hotline is area code 206-203-FRED. If you like, you can also send a voicemail via audio. There is a link on the website. You click on it, and as long as you've got a microphone on your computer, you can send me a voice comment. So please feel free to do that. And of course, you can always follow the Fredcast on Twitter. That's at www.twitter.com. And of course, there's a link on the page at www.thefredcast.com. I haven't mentioned it a lot lately, but something I'd love for you to do on a regular basis is spread the word about the Fredcast. Tell your friends, tell your riding buddies, tell the folks in the club. Go to Podcast Alley and vote for the Fredcast as one of your favorite podcasts. It's very easy to do. Just go to thefredcast.com and there's a link right there on the left-hand side of the page so that you can support the Fredcast in that way. Or go over to iTunes and leave a review about the show. I'd very much appreciate it. Speaking of iTunes, it's time, as it is every week, for our PodSafe cycling music. This week's music comes to us, as it always does, from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. And I said, speaking of iTunes, because this week's song is called You Don't Need an iPod by the band Uncle Seth. I've put links in the show notes to where you can find Uncle Seth on iTunes, on the PodShow site, and on the Uncle Seth website. Now, the reason I'm playing this is because I've had several people over the last couple of days, friends and colleagues who I thought were technically qualified, who said to me, I'd love to listen to your show, but I just don't have an iPod. So for those people, and you know who you are, here's Uncle Seth telling you that you don't need an iPod to listen to my podcast. Thanks to all of you for listening and for staying subscribed to the Fredcast. We'll be back in a couple of days with another show. In the meantime, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.